So welcome, everybody. I'm Tim Brennan. I'm the Treasurer, Chief Financial Officer of the Association. I'm also a member of the Investment Committee. And we have with us Carol McMullen, who is the Chair of the Investment Committee, and Simon Billiness, who is a member of the Socially Responsible Investment Committee. What we're going to talk about today is, first of all, the September quarterly performance. We've made a couple of changes in our fixed income managers. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about the recent investment committee meeting and the actions that the committee is taking. And then Simon is going to give us an update on shareholder advocacy, what we're working on this year. And then we will open it up for questions and answers. So you all should have the investor call materials. This was sent out to everybody who registered. If you did not register, you can go to the website, which is uucef.org. That's uucef.org. It stands for UU, Common Endowment Fund. And over on the right side, there is a link that says View November Investor Call Materials, and you can follow along there. So with that, let me pass the mic, the virtual mic, on to Carol McMullen, the Chair of the Investment Committee. And Carol, could you talk to us about recent performance and what the Investment Committee is working on?
Right. And you know what? I'm going to mix it up a little bit here. And I'm going to ask people actually to go to the appendix. I'm going to just talk briefly about the objectives of the portfolio and what we're trying to accomplish, and then go back and talk about performance. So I'm on page 16, which talks about the fund oversight. I know we've had conversations about that in the past, where we've really talked about the Board of Trustees, the role of the Investment Committee, Socially Responsible Committee, and you're hearing from both the Investment Committee and the Socially Responsibility Responsibility Investment Committee today, as well as the UUA Treasurer, Tim. So you get a sense from the three of us as to what's happening, but there's a whole team of people behind us, as shown on page 16. On 17, we really go through the investment objective, and I think it's important to keep this in mind. We are really looking to manage this portfolio to be consistent. We don't want to take too much risk. While risk is often commensurate with return, the higher the risk, the higher the return. This is really a moderate risk tolerance that we have. We're not looking to take either too much risk or be at the very high end, but we want to make sure that the congregations can take regular distribution, and we're really looking to protect principal after an adjustment for inflation and after all expenses come out. So while we don't target a particular number for absolute return, we are looking to return a number significantly above the addition of inflation and expenses, which is right now about 3.5%. We are therefore on page 18. It's a long-term portfolio. The committee works long-term. We're trying to make it diversified. Clearly, if we'd just been in S&P 500 U.S. stocks over the past several years, the returns would have been way better, but there's a risk associated with that. We pick individual managers into each specialist mandate of the diversified portfolio. And we do pay a lot of attention, as Simon will talk, to the management of the UU values, not just risk and return, but also justice. And our portfolio is open to all congregations, districts, and other organizations that are affiliated with the UU. And I will also add that certainly the Socially Investment Responsible Investment Committee and the Investment Committee work closely together. The portfolio on page 19 is fully diversified across all these asset classes: domestic equities, international equities, fixed income, global asset allocation, and hedge funds, which I will talk about as we go through. And on page 20, you'll see these asset allocation targets. This is kind of where we're targeted right now. And you will see the one that stands out like a sore thumb is global asset allocation. It wouldn't stand out like a sore thumb if it were performing better. But this group of managers has not, in aggregate, two of the three have not performed as well as we would have hoped, and therefore it's going to be one of the topics that we talk about during this call in a little bit more detail. So I just wanted to give you that overview, which was very well laid out in the appendix, and then come back and try to target my comments directly against those overview thoughts. So I'm now going back from the appendix to page 1. which we talk about the total performance summary, and you'll see that the composite, that is net of fees, because it says net in the parentheses up there, is, as you can see, for the first fiscal year to date, negative 1.9%, up 2.7% year to date, that's through September 30th, and then the numbers of 6.8%, 10.6%, 8.4%, and so on for the previous years. So if you take my number of inflation plus fees, and this is net of fees, so you just have to have inflation in there, inflation has probably averaged during this time frame somewhere between 0 and 4%, but probably most likely in the 2.5%, maybe 3% range. And so the portfolio has significantly outperformed that benchmark by all measures, except in the most recent short-term period of the fiscal year to date, when we've had a down market. You'll see that the domestic equities have performed obviously the best of all asset classes for a number of years, and international equities have performed better in prior years, in previous years, than in most recent time, when we've really had some very difficult periods in some of the international equity markets, especially the emerging markets and some of China. So fixed income composite, again, the fixed income alone has outperformed inflation throughout this period and has done really quite well as an aggregate. And so, you know, we have sort of between 4.5% and 5.5%, up to 6.5% in a couple of years of performance out of fixed income in the portfolio. The GTAA, Global Asset Allocators, have performed better than fixed income for most of the time that we've had them. Not true in the last year to date and for the most recent fiscal year, but not as well, obviously, as the U.S. equity market in particular, and even, you know, the sum total of international plus U.S. And you can see the performance of the other areas in there, and we'll have a little more conversation about those over time. On page 2, you will see that this is our asset allocation of the fund. The actual is in the third column, showing this is the look-through, we call it. This is the actual portfolio when we disaggregate all of the global asset allocation managers into the things that they own, because they can move amongst portfolios, amongst asset classes. We actually saw them and see them as tactical managers. We only meet quarterly. We can't possibly be moving things in and out daily and weekly, but they can. And so they really have been hired to try to go to where the opportunities are, and you can see that they have been wrong, in aggregate, I guess, about domestic equity, which has been better than many of the other asset classes to which they have allocated. And in particular, the fixed income area has been one where these managers have had, you know, some significant holdings, and they have done quite well in that arena. Some of the more real assets, commodities, have not done well. Some of the emerging equity and fixed income markets have not done as well, and so the total performance has been mixed within this group. You can see on page 3, we are the dot. The dot is our portfolio for the UUA. The triangle is where our allocation index would perform. So on average, we perform in line with or a little bit better than just a blind portfolio allocated to what we think is a reasonable benchmark for us. And you will see that we have not been as high in the rankings as we had been historically, although in short-term periods, the spread between good and bad managers, so to speak, hasn't been all that high. And so we have been performing sort of in line with or a little bit less than the median of those managers. Clearly, over the one-year period, we have not, and the 1 and 3-year periods, we have been performing, you know, at the median or a little bit below it. Not what we want to do.
I think you mean endowments. These are other
endowments. I'm sorry. What did I say? Other managers. I guess is the right. I'm sorry. Other managers. So, and it turns out that in this size range of managers, many of them are only U.S. equity holders. They have not been as diversified and as risk-averse over time as we have been. It paid off for us in the early years of managing the portfolio, but has not paid off versus this benchmark. If you look at page, this is the next, this is the first one is $50 to $250 million endowments. And I think that they're both that, both versus peer universes, Tim, is the problem, not versus the median managers, right?
Right, it's both the endowment size. Yeah, and the second chart is year by year as opposed
year
to
year by year, but
annualized.
It's all endowment size. Yeah, and I said benchmark, I'm very sorry, yeah. And these are the annualized numbers versus that same pool of managers, which shows us doing a little bit better in specific years and gives you a sense of how we perform versus other managers. The thing I always focus on, though, is if you look to the right-hand side of the page, as over longer periods of time, you tend to get more contraction in the spread between the best and worst managers, but it does really matter because you're talking about the difference between 10% and, say, 15 or 20% in some cases, even in relatively compressed periods. And so we really do strive to outperform both that group and benchmarks over time. As I promised you, global asset allocation and understanding it is one of the topics that we have here, which is shown on the next page, understanding GAA. This has been the area where we've had actually the most focus on the investment management, on the investment portfolio from the committee, because in fact it has not performed as well as we would have hoped. You will see that the various managers, Bridgewater, GMO, and Wellington, are the three managers each, and they're shown here as to their allocations in domestic energy equity, international equity, emerging markets, and what they actually hold as of the September 30th date, and then in aggregate on the right, what they hold and when you add them all together. So it is a highly diversified portfolio of international and domestic equity, international and domestic fixed income. And the part that has probably been the worst performing has been the alternative cash commodities shown in the bottom, sort of in a, I guess it's an orangey type of color that has been the focus of a lot of the conversations that we've had at the investment committee. We are meeting with each of the global asset allocation managers over the next month or two to probe and ask more questions. We want to make sure that this is a short term, i.e. it's already been most of this market cycle, but phenomenon where their diversification and their strategies have just not paid off and that they will pay off over time, or has there been a fundamental shift in either what they're doing or what's happening in the market such that we need to make a change here. I don't know the answer to that question, but it's one that we have been talking about for a while and have really begun to focus more and more of our team's attention on this. And some of the newer members of the committee, I think, will be very germane to having us have serious and deep conversations about this area, because it's been one that has caused some performance period for a while. And on the next page, page 8, you will see that what Tim and the group have done, which is fabulous, is it actually takes each of the managers that we have and talks about in the portfolio, not just the GAA managers, but also the overall managers, domestic equity, fixed income, the separate account managers, and talks about what they do, what the benchmark is, we manage them again, what their role is in the portfolio, so they trying to be growth, they trying to protect us, what's their goal, and then gives a little bit of a description about them so that you have a thumbnail sketch of each of these managers and can kind of see how we've put them all together, whether as growth assets, developed international, emerging markets, domestic fixed income, global fixed income. You see the name of the manager, what they do, and what we're trying to do with them. And specifically, Tim brought up the question of fixed income. We had identified that the PIMCO portfolio was one that we were beginning to move out of, gosh, Tim, I think it's 6 months or more.
Well, the discussion's been going on that long, but the movement has this happens at the May meeting, we decided to move half the money, and at the most recent meeting, we decided to move the other
half. And, but we've been having this conversation and working on it for a while and have feel very good about the two managers, as Tim had just said, one we did in May and one we just recently did here. One has more of a broad mandate of bonds, and the other is really more of a traditional domestic low-risk municipal bond and high-grade treasuries agencies and corporate bond manager. And both have sensitivity to socially ESG principles. And so we not only feel good about, you know, sort of the risk reduction and the splitting of these two parts of the bonds, but we feel good about the managers in terms of what they do for us. So that's a lot of information. I tried to go through quickly so that you have plenty of time for questions. And then I'm going to turn it over to Simon to talk about... is that what you'd like to do, Tim, and have, or do you want to have questions first?
No, let's go to Simon.
So I'll turn it over to Simon to update you post GA what we're doing and how the process is working.
Hi, this is Simon Villaness from the Committee on Socially Responsible Investments. And I just wanted to give you
Simon, this is Tim. Before you jump in, I think it might be helpful if you just said a little bit about your background.
Sorry, I didn't catch what you said, Tim.
I said I think it might be helpful if you'd say just a little bit about your professional background.
Oh, certainly. I worked in the field of socially responsible investments, particularly in the area of shareholder activism. And what I bring to the UA is, additional expertise on how we can use our power as shareholders in companies to change their behavior on areas of interest to our mission and our policy. So what we do is. when you have a large portfolio of stocks and as the UUA a large number of issues that are of interest and concern, it's kind of like drinking from a fire hose. When your job is to use your influence to make the world a better place, the to-do list in the morning can be a bit daunting. So what we do is we focus on areas where there is a solid grounding in UUA policy for the advocacy work. And so the areas that we focused on are areas where there's been resolutions passed by General Assembly and where there's clear grounding in our mission and our values. And so we've been on the cutting edge of a number of issues, including LGBT equality in the workplace, also on climate change. And we've also been focusing more on economic inequality. And these are all issues where there's a lot of support and a lot of grounding. One of the things that we've really been increasing this year, since there's been such a demonstrated interest in climate change, particularly as we saw with the business resolution on the fossil fuel companies that passed General Assembly this past June, we've been focusing a lot more on shareholder advocacy on the few fossil fuel companies that we remain invested in, and specifically focusing on issues around what's called carbon asset risk, which is a long way of saying, what we can do to influence these companies to, keep more carbon in the ground and not let it into the atmosphere. We've also looked around, also been focusing on the fossil fuel companies and their political donations, particularly where they, you know, where we feel they are, you know, unfairly influencing public policy around climate change. And we've also been involved in a number of you know, meetings and dialogues with these companies, as well as just shareholder resolutions. The other thing that we've been working on is on GLBT non-discrimination. You know, we've worked for many years with the New York State Employees Retirement System to press ExxonMobil to add sexual orientation to the non-discrimination statement. This is something we've been doing for over a decade now, and we don't think we should give up until, you know, ExxonMobil agrees to do that. They're the only Fortune 100 company to lack that kind of policy. And also, we've been, on that issue, we've been, you know, expanding that over the last few years from just focusing on sexual orientation to also adding gender identity into companies' non-discrimination statements. And that's another area where we, you know, as you use, continue to push the envelope in terms of advocacy by shareholders. And one other thing that is we talked about before, and boy, Dan, we've also been focusing on corporate political donations and lobbying. One of the things that we were proud of doing, you know, being proud of doing, is putting pressure on companies to pull out of a conservative lobbying group, ALEC. And you know, this is a association which has, you know, pushed all kinds of regressive legislation, including stand your ground laws and attacking at the state level policies on climate change. And we're part of a large group of shareholders and others who've been pressing companies to end their membership in ALEC and to stop supporting this kind of regressive lobbying and legislation, particularly at the state level. The thing that we're looking to expand more on this year, aside from expanding our work on climate change, is looking for ways in which we can tackle issues of economic inequality. And so we've been joining with shareholders who've been working on issues of farm worker rights, particularly working with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida, and their battles to get supermarkets and fast food chains to pay a little extra for their tomatoes and pass that on to workers in the form of higher wages. And we're also exploring ways in which we could also add our weight to the growing organizing by fast food workers around higher wages and better conditions at fast food companies. So it's a very large and diverse set of issues that we do shareholder advocacy on. And, you know, I think it really demonstrates how we can, as a religious denomination, through our endowment, you know, really punch above our weight in terms of advocacy and in terms of our assets. So that's what we did in a broad brush. And there's a lot more information about specific companies and how we're tackling specific issues on the UUCEF website.
Great. Thanks, Simon. And Simon, you were a little bit, I think, shy in talking about your background. I'll just add to what you said that Simon is currently the executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Burma and had a recent meeting at the White House prior to the president's trip to Burma. He's also consulted to the AFL-CIO and served on the board of Amnesty International. So Simon really has deep experience. Of course, he is a volunteer, a lay leader, and brings that expertise to the UUA as his gift, and we appreciate that, just as all the members of the investment committee work without any compensation, or at least dollar compensation. And I just wanted to add a little bit to what Carol was talking about. The other thing that the investment committee has been working on is thinking about positive investments that address climate change and sustainability. So one of the two managers that we hired in the fixed income area, Breckenridge Capital Management, that portfolio that they are putting together, for the bond portfolio, will include some green bonds and some infrastructure bonds that really go right to moving capital towards climate solutions. And at the same time, the committee is also starting a process of looking at private investments. This would be private equity, private debt, private real estate funds. This is all new to us, so we just went through a real deep educational session with our investment consultant. And over the next year, actually years, we'll be looking for opportunities in that space. And that is an area where capital can really play a large role in developing climate solutions. So that will be a focus for our portfolio over the coming years. With that, let me ask if there are any questions. Each of you has the ability to unmute your phone by pressing *6. So if you press *6, you'll be able to ask a question of any of us here on the panel. So I think I heard somebody unmute. Why don't you identify yourself and go ahead. Maybe I didn't hear anything. While we wait for a question, let me just ask.
My name is Cecil Blocker.
Oh, great. Go ahead, Cecil.
I'm understanding the GAA, that chart. It had Bridgewater 42.8% in, it looks like, real assets. And I was curious, what are they?
Well, it's real assets and cash. And I don't actually know the breakdown of how much.
No, the color shows real assets.
I'm sorry, which one are we looking at?
Alternatives and cash.
Alternatives
flesh
and
color
cash.
Color is alternatives and cash.
Yeah. And on the right-hand side, I think in the little box that gives the key, it says just real assets. So I just want to make sure that, yeah.
That's what I was
yeah,
interested in what those were.
It's alternatives and cash. And Bridgewater can hold a significant amount of cash. So I don't know how much of that is cash, and I just wanted to say that up front. But it could be things like timberland. It could be things like commodities.
In the case of Bridgewater, it's probably derivatives. That's what Bridgewater does. They're not actually making.
They buy derivatives.
They're not buying the timberland,
but they could buy the derivatives in it. Yeah.
Exactly.
I got you.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much.
But some of the other ones probably do hold actual investments.
Yes, exactly. It occurs to me, Carol. You know, maybe in a future call we should spend a little time talking about Bridgewater and this whole risk parity strategy that they use, which is quite unlike the other two GAA managers. But we'll leave
that to
the next call.
Yeah, no, that would probably be a good topic. But, yes, it is a combination of many things, most of which in that bucket are derivatives.
Right. So *6 if you want to ask a question.
Okay, this is Elizabeth Scarborough in South Bend, Indiana. I've been taking notes furiously here, and I'm wondering if Carol might give us a brief takeaway overall in terms of what she was talking about and what we need to know about.
I think that, you know, bottom line is that the investment landscape is very mixed right now. You've got some people believing we've been in a long-term depression worldwide, of which the U.S. is not in a depression. But you've got very poor economic conditions in Japan and in Europe, pretty strong conditions in the U.S., and very mixed in emerging markets. And what that leads this investment committee to think and to believe is that we have to hold a very diversified portfolio of asset classes around the world with very good managers, because you actually don't know exactly what's going to happen next. There's not a lot of clarity, and there's a lot of different types of themes. I think sort of one takeaway is that the world is complex and global, and we want to have a highly diversified portfolio. Secondly, we are trying to not take too much risk in that portfolio. We want to make sure that it is getting an adequate return to give to protect principal and to give the congregations enough growth to be able to fulfill their missions and to make distributions as needed. But we don't want to take a tremendous amount of undue risk. So even within the broadly diversified portfolio that we have, most of the managers are selected for being broad-based against certain benchmarks and established, proven, reputable, and well-run organizations, as well as people who know how to pick stocks and bonds. And then thirdly, that we know that with quarterly meetings and setting a policy and an overview, that we can't be there day in and day out to make adjustments to the portfolio to reflect tactical, shorter-term movements, which are highly likely in this uncertain world. And so we have decided to put that into the portfolio in terms of the global asset allocation managers who can and do and are expected to make tactical movements amongst these asset classes as they see fit. But we do obviously monitor them, watch them, and work with them regularly. And then finally, I think to Simon's point, is we really do pay a lot of attention to doing this as best as possible, not just from a performance and a quality standpoint, but also in paying attention to the values of the UU mission. And whenever we have an opportunity or a choice, and the performance outcomes we think are similar, we are trying to implement ESG in the portfolio. Does that help you?
Yes, it surely does. Thank you.
And let me remind those who ask questions to press star 6 when you're done to silence your phone. Is there anybody else with a question? Star 6 to open up your phone if it's muted.
This is Joan Cuddy.
Hey, Joan.
Hi. I've calculated the percent of community development of the total $187 million, and it's less than 1%. It's 0.8%, and I'm wondering if there is a plan to beef it up to at least 1%.
Yeah, well, that, of course, falls into the responsibility of the Socially Responsible Investing Committee. If you've been tracking it, the balance of the fund has gone up quite a bit in the last quarter or two, and that... I mean, partly it's been market return, but much more than that, there was a major contribution from the Liberal Religious Charitable Society, and there was proceeds from the sale of our Beacon Hill properties. So that added over $15 million to the endowment fund. Part of it is that we just haven't quite caught up with that. And in addition, there have been some congregations joining the fund. So the committee is looking at certain opportunities. They've actually committed, voted for a couple in principle, and we're waiting for documentation from those opportunities. One is a housing fund down in Prince George's County outside of Washington, D.C. that was so hard hit by the foreclosure crisis, and another one is a cooperative housing project organized by a lot of our young UUs. So, but those are they're not quite ready for funding, but we've set aside an allocation for those. And then the member of our committee who really works on this stuff, Joan, you may know Marva Williams. She actually is a member or works for the Federal Reserve Bank on their CDFI program. So she's an expert in the field, and she is identifying some opportunities for investment in the Portland area, so those can be coordinated with our next General Assembly. We did a couple down in Rhode Island last year for our General Assembly, and we will do one or two more in Portland this year. So they are very cognizant of the capacity to make some more community investments, and they're working on it.
Great. Thank you. Good news.
Any more questions? Press star 6.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, this is Marion from Knoxville, Tennessee. Perhaps a not very astute question, but when you say community development investment, I presume that's loans?
Yes.
So
under our policy, this is the board's policy, which has been longstanding for years, we allocate 1% of the endowment fund to investments that go to underserved communities. And this is generally called community investments. It includes things like housing funds, community development funds, microloans internationally, a lot of different things like that. And they are generally below market interest rates. They're almost always structured as a loan or a note. And that's just been part of our commitment for, decades to put some of our assets into investments that serve communities that generally do not have access to financial resources.
Do you know what the return rate is on those? Do they get paid back well or
we
not?
We've never had a default.
Wow.
While I've been here, and I don't know of one in the past. So they have always paid back the principal when it's due. Interest rates are generally below market and range from say 1-3% in that range.
In this
crazy market, with the quantitative easing, it actually sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
But over the long term, it's generally we've been 1-2% below what a similar kind of treasury bill would be. But these days, it's kind of competitive. But obviously, it's higher risk. But we're happy to do that. And the committee has generally decided not to do insured investments. So, for instance, like credit unions and such, because those are insured, there's more capital for that. So we try to have a little extra leverage by investing where there isn't. But we're very careful about who we invest in. As I say, we have a member of the committee who has professional expertise in the area, and the committee and she look at every single investment, and we try to be prudent, but also make a contribution towards change where it's needed.
Okay, thank you.
Well, and this is Carol to the last questioner. So I was born in Knoxville and raised in Oak Ridge.
You were. Well, I lived in Oak Ridge and moved to Knoxville. So.
There you go.
Tim? Ward,
yes.
Chelsea calling.
Could
I ask a quick follow-up on what you were just talking about? Is that portion of the UUCEF portfolio, is that where the matching money comes for individual congregations who help buy into that kind of notes and stuff?
Yes. So
okay.
approximately $350,000 or $400,000 of that total,
right.
Of that total is actually... So we're at about $1.5 million, so a little less than a third of that is made up of the matching funds. This is where a congregation can invest $10,000 in a certified CDFI, and then the UUA will invest alongside of them.
Yeah. Well, I want to tell you quickly that we have done that, and we really appreciate it. But now, if I might, I have another question that was really what was on my mind before this came up. I'm sort of zeroing in on this whole notion of investing with some idea of affecting climate change. And I have two questions, really. One would be pretty much directed to Simon. I think the other I'll throw up to anybody. The first one is, are there any of the old school energy companies that are doing anything really, substantially to the better in this area? And my second question would be, what are the financial prospects for some of these alternative energy entrepreneurs or enterprises?
Okay, I'll jump in on the first one, and Simon will probably have something to add. But I would say, yes, we're seeing, you know, the lions are not yet rollicking in the fields with the lambs. I'm seeing some significant change both out front and behind the scenes. So on the out front side, we saw Conoco actually set a greenhouse gas reduction target publicly, which is pretty amazing. I think they're the only major to do that. And then behind the scenes, and I mean, we are actually in serious conversations with top managers at these companies, and I have heard the whole climate denial thing disappear. So one really big company that I can't name because it was a private conversation.
Sure.
Said, we asked them, well, what is your position on climate change and climate science? And they said, we actually don't have a position because we don't have climate scientists. Therefore, we accept the findings of the International Panel on Climate Change. We have no difference with that because we don't have the expertise to have a difference. So I thought that was significant from just a few years ago when the same company was funding one of these goofy climate denial groups.
Hope these guys are spreading the word around Oklahoma.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. And then just a third one I'll throw out is our international investment manager, Boston Common Asset Management, was putting pressure on Stat Oil using our holding in that company, among others, but in using our holding. They have exposure to the tar sands, and they were making the point that this is so expensive that it could be a very bad investment. And in response, Stat Oil cancels their the prospective huge project that they were going to do in the tar sands.
Great.
So
good.
Yes. So
yeah,
I think,
that's great.
I think
it's good to
we're
hear
making,
there are a few.
You know, we're chipping away.
Some are seeing the light. Okay.
Yeah. Simon, do you want to add?
I think that was a good, you know, a good summation. I mean, I think, what we had hoped to see was these fossil fuel companies make the change to being energy companies and to, you know, invest in solar power, for instance, geothermal, other renewable energies. We're not seeing them do that, unfortunately. And those that did before, like BP and Chevron, have actually sold off those renewable energy projects. So as Tim pointed out, so we're at the stage with these old line fossil fuel companies of adding to the pressure on them to abandon some of their riskier and higher cost projects, projects that would that shouldn't even get online, not just from a climate change perspective, but from a financial perspective. It's simply a bad investment. And that's where we can, where we can get some of these big companies to make an incremental change, but one that also, because they're so big, has a big impact on climate change.
So my second question was, and I'm sorry to take so much time, but my second question is sort of, what are the financial prospects for some of these newer alternative energy enterprises, if you know?
Yeah, this is Tim. What I would say is that generally the committee is going to be very cautious and prudent about this. So we're not going to be making any direct investments in companies. We're going to be investing in funds and managers. So we're looking. I mean, we're looking for managers with good track record and good expertise that that are going to be able to deliver not just a market return, but if we're going to have an illiquid investment, we expect to get an outsized return to compensate us for illiquidity. So we're not just saying, oh, we want to go do good and, you know, and maybe lose our money. We're looking for managers and strategies that are sophisticated and that, you know, our investment consultants, New England Pension Consultants, believes is competitive with anything else. And it's not going to be easy, you know, so we're not rushing into it. We're going to take our time and find those opportunities. I mean, what I will tell you, I was just at the SRI conference in Colorado last week, and this whole arena is just changing so rapidly. I mean, the cost of generating electricity from wind and solar in many areas in the country now is competitive with natural gas and coal. So this is going to just start driving change very quickly, which means, you know, that there will be opportunities, but then there is also going to be risks. So we're going to proceed with caution.
I know that there are a number of commercial, if I can use the word commercial, mutual funds out there that are for-profit enterprises that are also now touting funds that are investing in alternative energy sources. So I was wondering what you thought. Okay, thanks.
And the, I guess the other thing I would say is I think what we're looking at is really something that I would frame more as investing in sustainability, and so not as narrow as clean tech. I mean, there's a great clean tech opportunity, great, but we're also looking at, you know, infrastructure. We're looking at, waste treatment, waste management, other kinds of opportunities that move towards a more sustainable future.
Okay, thanks, Tim. I tied up this thing long enough.
That's okay. Good question.
This is Robert Johnson.
Hey, Robert.
I have a question about this GTAA that we have got, which is about 30% of the total portfolio. And I was wondering if Tim, you, and Carol are comfortable with this mode of investing, where we're giving three of our mutual funds sort of a wild card, or it seems that way to me, maybe you could clarify that, to do whatever they think is best. And I was wondering, what's the underlying rationale for this decision, and how long is the investment committee comfortable with staying with some of these managers who seem to be not performing as well as we wish? Thank you.
Yeah, no, again, that was part of what I was trying to address in the comments. Clearly, first of all, they're not just given a free card. We pick these managers, and we have reason to believe that the areas of expertise that they claim to have, they do have. And so they have some ability to move within specific ranges, but not, you know, wildly and without any abandon or oversight. So I want to be really clear about that. Secondly, the thinking is that there's a core of the portfolio that is traditional U.S. equities and fixed income, international equities, and plain vanilla, I guess, is the way that you would describe it, and that we've tried to build sort of a satellite for some opportunistic situations around that, be it community development, be it the private opportunities that Tim mentioned we would like to have, be it the hedge fund of HUNs that we do have. And by the way, the global asset allocation managers have performed roughly in line with or a little bit better, in fact, than the hedge fund managers. And that's not totally inconsistent. In many ways, they are thought to be absolute return managers and people who are paying attention to risk-adjusted returns around the world. So they're not bond managers. They have way more risk and way more room to maneuver than bond managers, but they, you know, have this broad mandate. And I think the second piece is, as I said, we can't be there every month, every quarter, every day to make tactical allocation decisions. And again, the purpose of these managers was to have them
And these are well-known, highly regarded, well-vetted managers do that on our behalf. It may or may not be working, right? It's certainly not a disaster in any stretch of the imagination, but they have not performed as well as we might have hoped that they would perform in this environment. Because, in fact, the benchmarks are difficult to evaluate for these managers because they do have a lot of room to maneuver. So, as I said, we are interviewing them all individually. We're spending a lot of time thinking about it. You have to be very careful of these things. We make long-term decisions, and we don't want to obviously pull out from underneath a manager just at the time they're going to start performing better, and that we've lived through the bad times and we don't get the benefit of the good times. And so we're really trying to understand where they are, why they're positioned the way they're positioned, what they think is going to happen in the world, and to test that against our own assumptions and our own views of what's happening. So, no, we won't tolerate underperformance forever, but we also don't just willy-nilly move from one side of the boat to the other. That's the surest way to lose money. And so we are trying to be thoughtful in our approach and balanced and look at the measurements and the risk-adjusted returns and listen to the managers to understand what they think, what we think about what they're doing.
Yeah,
I can't predict the future, so I don't know what we're going to do, but we are actively involved in those conversations.
Well, thank you. That's some comfort. Tim, you have something on that, please?
Yeah, I was just going to add that, we're in a funny place in the market with the yields from bonds so low, and over the last couple of years, if you invested in a, I don't know who's got the siren, but if you could star six, that would be good. Anybody who invested in a U.S. equity index fund looked like a genius, because U.S. equities have been galloping, so any active manager is really highly challenged these days. We all know that markets go in cycles, and that's not going to go on forever. And when that turns, more diversified investors are going to be in much better shape. So that translates directly to, I think, the global asset allocation managers who are diversified across a wide array of assets. They're not all loaded into U.S. equities right now, and so they don't look as good as somebody who is. But I there was a congregation that just told me they're moving all their assets to U.S. Equity index fund, and I just thought, boy, that is not good timing, because it's not going to run forever. So I think that's part of the answer there, is that it's not a time when active managers have been outperforming.
Well, it'll be interesting to know when active managers do outperform and to what extent they do so with some regularity. Anyway,
yep.
Thank you so much.
Yep, I agree with you. Yep. I think that's about all the time we've got. So hope if anybody has a question that they didn't get to ask, they will just forward that directly to me. You can send me an email or call. Easiest email address to remember is probably just treasurer@uua.org. That goes right to my email box, and we will be happy to respond to any further questions. So thanks again to Carol McMullen. Carol, thanks so much for all you do for us and for being on this call. And Simon, thanks to you. Really appreciate you taking the time to be on the call and talk about the great work you do on our behalf. And with that, thanks to all of you for participating.
Thank
it was
you
a
all.
Good conversation.
Okay.
Thank you all.
Bye-bye.
Bye.